The last days of school before Christmas seemed interminable. Each night, I fell asleep with the hope that the morning would bring Papa, and each morning, when he wasn't there, I trudged to school, consoling myself that he would be home when I returned. But the days passed, prickly, cold, and windy, and he didn't come. Added to the misery of the waiting and the cold was Lillian Jean, who managed to flounce past me with a superior smirk twice that week. I had already decided that she had had two flounces too many, but since I hadn't yet decided how to handle the matter, I postponed doing anything until after I had had a chance to talk with Papa about the whole strawberry business. I knew perfectly well that he would not tear out of the house after Mr. Sims, as Uncle Hammer had done, for he always took time to think through any move he made, but he would certainly advise me on how to handle Lillian Jean. Then, too, there was TJ, who, although not really my problem, was so obnoxiously flaunting Stacy's wool coat during these cold days that I had just about decided to deflate him at the same time I took care of Lillian Jean. Ever since the night Mr. Avery had brought him to the house to return the coat, and he had been told by Uncle Hammer and a faltering Stacy that the coat was his, TJ had been more unbearable than usual. He now praised the coat from the wide tips of its lapels to the very edges of its deep hem. No one had ever had a finer coat. No one had ever looked better in such a coat. No one could ever hope to have such a coat again. Stacy was restrained from plugging TJ's mouth by Uncle Hammer's principle that a man did not blame others for his own stupidity. He learned from his mistake and became stronger for it. I, however, was not so restrained, and as far as I was concerned, if TJ kept up with this coat business, he could just hit the dirt at the same time as Miss Lillian Jean. The day before Christmas, I woke to the soft murmuring of quiet voices gathered in the midnight blackness of morning. Big Ma was not beside me, and without a moment's doubt, I knew why she was gone. Jumping from the bed, my feet barely hitting the deerskin rug, I rushed into Mama's room. "Oh, Papa," I cried, "I knew it was you." "Ah, there's my Cassie girl," Papa laughed, standing to catch me as I leapt into his arms. By the dawn, the house smelled of Sunday. Chicken frying, bacon sizzling, and smoked sausages baking. By evening, it reeked of Christmas. In the kitchen, sweet potato pies, egg custard pies, and rich butter pound cakes cooled. A gigantic coon, which Mr. Morrison, Uncle Hammer, and Stacy had secured in a night's hunt, baked in a sea of onions, garlic, and fat yellow-orange yams. And a choice, sugar-cured ham, brought from the smokehouse, awaited its turn in the oven. In the heart of the house, where we had gathered after supper, freshly cut branches of long-needled pines lay over the fireplace mantel, adorned by winding vines of winter holly and bright red Christmas berries. And in the fireplace itself, in a black pan set on a high wire rack, peanuts roasted over the hickory fire as the waning light of day swiftly deepened into a fine velvet night speckled with white forerunners of a coming snow, and the warm sound of husky voices and rising laughter mingled in tales of sorrow and happiness of days past but not forgotten. Them watermelons of old man Ellis's seemed like they just naturally tasted better than anybody else's, said Papa. And old Hammer and me, we used to sneak up there whenever it gets so hot you couldn't hardly move and take a couple of them melons on down to the pond and let them get real chilled. Then, talking about eating, we did some kind of good eating.
Papa, you were stealing?
Asked an astonished little man. Although he usually strongly disapproved of being held, he was now reclining comfortably in Papa's lap.
Well, Papa said, not exactly. What we'd do was exchange one of the melons from our patch for his. Course, It was still wrong for us to do it, but at the time it seemed all right. Problem was, though, laughed Uncle Hammer, old man Ellis grew them old fat green round watermelons, and ours was long and striped.
And Mr. Ellis was always right particular about his melons, interjected Papa.
He took the longest time to figure out what we was up to, but Lord, Lord, when he did,
you should have seen us run, Uncle Hammer said, standing.
He shot one hand against and past the other.
Man, we was gone. And that old man was right behind us with a hickory stick hitting us upside the head. Owie! That old man could run, cried Papa. I didn't know nobody's legs could move that fast.
Big Ma chuckled. And as I recalls, your papa about wore y'all out when Mr. Ellis told him what y'all been up to.
Course, you know all them Ellises was natural-born runners. Y'all remember Mr. Ellis's brother, Tom Lee? Well, one time he...
Through the evening, Papa and Uncle Hammer and Big Ma and Mr. Morrison and Mama lent us their memories, acting out their tales with stage-worthy skills, imitating the characters in voice, manner, and action so well that the listeners held their sides with laughter. It was a good, warm time. But as the night deepened and the peanuts in the pan grew shallow, the voices grew hushed, and Mr. Morrison said, "They come down like ghosts that Christmas of 76. Them was hard times like now. And my family was living in a shanty town right outside Shreveport. Reconstruction was just about over then, and them northern soldiers was tired of being in the south. And they didn't hardly care about no black folks in shanty town. And them southern whites, they was tired of the northern soldiers and free Negroes. And they was trying to turn things back round to how they used to be. And the colored folks, well, we were just tired. Weren't hardly no work. And during them years, I suppose it was just about as hard being free as it was being a slave. That night they come, I can remember just as good. It was cold, so cold, we had to huddle against each other, just trying to keep warm. And two boys, about 18 or 19, I reckon, come knocking on my daddy's door. They were scared, clean out of their heads with fright. They just come back from Shreveport. Some white woman done accused them of molesting her, and they didn't know nowhere to run. So they come up to my daddy's, 'cause he had a good head, and he was big, bigger than me. He was strong, too. So strong he could break a man's leg easy as if he was snapping a twig. I seen him do it that night. And the white folks were scared of him. But my daddy didn't hardly have time to finish hearing them boys' story when them devilish night men swept down. Night men, I echoed in a shrill, dry whisper. Stacy, sitting beside me on the floor, stiffened. Christopher John nudged me knowingly. Little man leaned forward on Papa's lap. David, Mama started, but Papa enfolded her slender hand in his and said quietly, "These are things they need to hear, baby. It's their history." Mama sat back, her hand still in Papa's, her eyes wary. But Mr. Morrison seemed not to notice. "Swept down like locusts," he continued in a faraway voice. "Burst in on us with their rebel sabers. Hacking and killing, burning us out. Didn't care who they killed. We weren't nothing to them. No better than dogs. Killed babies and old women. Didn't matter." He gazed into the fire. "My sisters got killed in their fire, but my mama got me out.